Hello there, and welcome to the latest and very exciting instalment of Cooper Talks, where I, Cooper, will talk. It's not an imaginative name, but hey, it's what I go for. So today I'm going to be talking about the Hungarian Uprising, which is part of the Cold War series of podcasts that I've been working on. There's been a bit of a gap since the last one, but yeah. So this was from 1956, and we're looking at what happened in Hungary in that year. But I'm going to start off by going into a bit of context to help understand the issues in the wider context of the Cold War. Now, Hungary had, unsurprisingly, been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire up until the end of World War One, when part of the Treaty of Versailles settlement saw national self-determination coming through. There's a little bit of a link back to the Treaty of Versailles and Woodrow Wilson's 14-point speech. Always good revision. But yeah, the Hungarians, Hungary became, was it a kingdom or a republic? I think it was a kingdom. But anyway, Hungary became an independent state and one of the many states in Eastern Europe, which obviously delighted many Hungarians. Now, it set up and it was doing quite well as an independent state, but in 1938, it allied itself with Nazi Germany and basically ended up becoming a Nazi dictatorship, or a fascist dictatorship, I should say, a fascist dictatorship and a close ally of greater Nazi Germany. So it wasn't officially part of the German Empire, but it was a key supporting player. Now, not many Hungarians were very happy about that, and they kind of felt resigned to it, and considering what happened in Czechoslovakia in 1938, they kind of accepted this probably the way to go, and at least they were nominally independent. Now, during World War II, as part of Germany's coalition of supporters, I suppose part of the Axis powers, Hungary benefited quite a lot. It is involved in the division of Czechoslovakia and took over parts of Czechoslovakia after Germany had annexed the key bits following on from Hitler's broken promises over appeasement. And it would then go on and take over parts of what is modern day Romania, even into places like Ukraine, Poland, and modern Yugoslavia, parts of Serbia and Croatia as well. So initially, up to 1941, it was a key part of the Axis powers and gained a lot, which at the time Hungarians were quite happy and pleased about that. But as the Red Army from the Soviet Union came pouring through from Eastern Europe in 1944, they advanced and basically invaded and conquered Hungary, taking over a lot of key positions and pushing the Hungarian and Nazi German army right the way back to the borders of Austria and Germany, and then pushing on through. Now, this obviously was devastating for the people of Hungary, caused a lot of hardship, and it was summed up by, in 1944, Budapest, the capital city of Hungary, was occupied, and the street names were changed to the Cyrillic alphabet. So very clear that this was a Russian-Soviet invasion, and it looked like they intended to be there for a long time, which was obviously very worrying for a number of Hungarians who were concerned about Soviet communist control. Now, in 1945, the war comes to an end, and we have the Potsdam Peace Conference. Joseph Stalin, as you may recall, he had promised that Hungary, amongst the other occupied nations, the nations that had been liberated by the Red Army, by the Soviet Union, would be allowed to have free elections to choose their government, their system of government. So it would be a form of democracy. Now, as you'll recall from previous episode, or go back and check out the episode on the peace conferences, there was a mixed set of results. Some countries legitimately or not so legitimately, couldn't go much higher there, chose to go communist. But initially, in the elections of 1945, there was a multi-party election, and overwhelmingly the Hungarians voted for the Independent Smallholders Party. Now, what sort of party is that? You'd probably call it a left-wing party because they're pretty much the only ones that were allowed to stand in these elections that were overseen by the Red Army and the Soviet Union. But they were very much Hungarian. They certainly were not communist. They were kind of centre-left, maybe not socialist, but a centre-left democratic party. They got 59.9% of the vote, so nearly 60% of the vote. The next highest party was the Hungarian Communist Party with 17.1%, and then the 16.9% for the Hungarian Social Democrat Party, another centre-left one. 5.6% for the National Peasant Party and 0.5% of the vote for the Civic Democratic Party. So overwhelmingly, in these free and fair elections, which only had left-wing parties, but still, these elections in Hungary, the Hungarians had quite categorically rejected communism and had chosen the Independent Smallholders Party. So the Hungarians thought, great, we voted for this, we're going to have a democratic system, we're going to rule our own affairs again. And the person who became the leader, I think president of Hungary at this time, was Imre Nagy. That's spelled N-A-G-Y. I had the great fortune to teach someone from Hungary once who explained to me how to pronounce it, because for ages I've been calling him Nagy, but it's Nagy, apparently. Please do feel free to point out if I'm making that completely wrong, but I have it on good authority. Now, Nagy then, very centrist guy, leader of the Independent Smallholders Party. Left-wing, yes, but certainly not a communist at this stage. Now, the hardline communists, both in Hungary and in the Soviet Union, were not very happy about this because they had wanted the Hungarians to choose communism. And they weren't very happy that they hadn't chosen communism. So they began something called a salami strategy. Now, what does that mean? It means they began thinly slicing away support for the Independent Smallholders Party. There'd be some arrests going on, there'd be some media attacks, and then other people would be convinced to join the communists and change their support. So slowly chipping away, slicing away like a thin slice of salami from a big piece of salami sausage, stripping away the support that Imre Nagy had. And so by the time there were new elections in 1947, the Independent Smallholders Party had been reduced in size and eligibility, and the Communist Party ended up being victorious. Now, despite the 2 years of the salami strategy, the Hungarian Communist Party still only got to about 24.3% of the vote. So still only a quarter of people actually voted communist, but they were the biggest single party. And the Independent Smallholders Party, after these 2 years of attacks, had sunk down to... the Communist Party had 22.2, so not even a quarter. The Independent Smallholders Party had sunk all the way down to 15.3 after the campaigns by the hardline communists. There were many other parties there, but the Communist Party had won. And that was enough. Okay, that was enough for them to claim a mandate from the people. Remember, less than a quarter of the population had actually voted for them. But that was enough. As far as the hardline communists and the Soviet Union was concerned, 1947, the people of Hungary had chosen to become a communist party state, even though fewer than a quarter, or less than a quarter of the population had actually chosen the communists. It was enough. Nagy, realizing that this was not good for him, and he was probably in a very dangerous position. Remember, 47, Stalin is still in power in the Soviet Union, and well, he may not have known about the purges going on then, but people had an idea. So he was worried, and he fled to Switzerland to go into hiding temporarily. Now, meanwhile, in Budapest itself, the hardline communists took over and started a hostile takeover, if you like, imposing communist rule, banning all the other political parties that had existed, arresting, so now he was quite right to run away, arresting party leaders, building statues of Stalin and Lenin and Karl Marx and putting up iconography everywhere, and basically transforming Hungary into a a Soviet communist state modelled on the Soviet Union, so a new satellite state. Now, one of the figures that would end up becoming in charge, the leader of the Communist Party in Hungary, and do remember that the leader of the Communist Party was effectively the boss, okay? The president of the country was kind of an honorary position. Actually, in Hungary, both positions will be held by a man called Rákosi. Okay, so Rákosi ends up becoming both president of Hungary and leader of the Hungarian Communist Party. He was a traditional hardline communist whose attitudes and ideas very much aligned with the Soviet Union. This was not good news for the Hungarian people, because it meant they were going to be imposed with a hardline communist regime, which would have limited trade, no free capitalism. It would mean state police, lack of freedoms, and the things of liberal democracy that they had perhaps hoped for. Also, it would mean no martial aid when that comes along, because Stalin wasn't keen on that. So, yeah, the Hungarians were pretty upset and worried about this. Now, key things that Rákosi outlawed in his bid to make a strong communist state: free speech completely banned, freedom of the press as well, as I mentioned, outlawed opposition parties and arrested any political dissidents, and they could be sent to trial, they could be sent to jail without a trial, without due process of law, so very much a police state being set up. He also, and this probably is the one that hurt the Hungarians the most in terms of national pride, he allowed the Red Army, the Russian Soviet, the USSR's army, to remain in Hungary for safety and security purposes, he would allege. But basically to allow them to stay as an occupying force, even though the war was long gone at this point. And not only were they allowed to stay, but the Hungarians had to pay for the privilege of having them stay. So this was... this was very unpopular with Hungary, but what could they do? If they complain, they get arrested and free speech has been banned. So it's going to lead to a degree of resentment. Now, by 1956, so about 9 years on from these events, the Hungarian people are fed up and Hungary's not in a good way. The financial policies of Comecon have not done Hungary any favours. It's been getting progressively poorer. And what happens is a division emerges within the Communist Party. Now, that's quite an important thing to remember. Everything is going to be run and controlled by the Communist Party of Hungary. But the party itself has two factions or two sides. There's the moderate side, and the moderate side wants things to be slightly better for the Hungarians. We're going to see this time and again in other uprisings that occur. But if you like, communism with a human face. They weren't anti-communist. Okay, these are all members of the Communist Party of Hungary. But they're moderate. They don't like the hardcore elements. Then, of course, you have, on the other hand, the hardcore elements of the Hungarian Communist Party. And Rákosi was a key figure there. These divisions ended up with fighting within the Communist Party of Hungary, because people realized that Hungarians were not embracing communism, they weren't happy, and there was a sense of danger that the way communism was being imposed was actually alienating people, and they wanted people to love communism and to embrace it. So the moderates want to impose changes, but the radicals are resisting it. I suppose the analogy I'd use is like a clenched fist. Okay, the hardliners think you've got to seize the Hungarian people and keep them tightly locked up in a clenched fist. And if you relax it a little bit, they'll get carried away and exploited by the West, and they'll all want rights and liberties and freedoms and stuff like that. the moderates say, no, it's the clenched fist that's causing all the problems. If we relax the fist a little bit and let people breathe and relax, then they'll love communism and they'll see all the benefits of it. So that's kind of where the division's going. Now, Rakosi doesn't like this. So Rakosi wants to eliminate the moderates and basically remove them from the Hungarian Communist Party and be got done with them. So Rakosi comes up with a bit of a plan, and he travels to Moscow. Well, he appeals to Moscow and to the new Soviet leader, Nikolai Khrushchev. Now, remember, Stalin had died in 1953, famously, had a stroke, but everyone was too scared to open the door, so it's too late by the time they got to him. That's another story. And originally a troika of three leaders had taken over shared leadership of the Soviet Union, of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. But Khrushchev would emerge by 1956 as kind of the sole leader, and Hungary was a chance for him to stamp his authority. Now, Khrushchev had led a policy, or was leading a policy of de-Stalinization. He was saying, actually, all that clenched fist stuff that Stalin did, all the purges, the terror, that was bad. That put people off communism. So he wanted to change tack. He published all the horrific, well, not all, but he made public knowledge of the show trials and the purges and the gulags that Stalin had authorized. And he's saying, we're not like that anymore. We're going to be nice communism. So again, the moderates in Hungary are saying, hey, Khrushchev is speaking our language. He gets us. This, we're going to follow his lead here. So when Rakosi appeals to Khrushchev and says, hey, Khrushchev, can you help me to get rid of these moderates who are trying to relax things in Hungary? Khrushchev says no. And basically uses his position as chairman of the Soviet Union Communist Party to force Rakosi out of power, and tells him to retire. So that's it. Rakosi's effectively, we'll say retired rather than sacked. He's put out to pasture. Says, right, you're gone now. And he's replaced initially by a guy called Giro. Unfortunately, Giro was also quite a hardline communist, and he had some very strict ideas. And the Hungarian people weren't very happy about this. In fact, in many ways, they saw Giro as worse for Hungary than Rakosi had been. So that led to student protests. So in Budapest, a number of the students from the university came out to protest against Giro and the restrictions. And it got to the stage where they actually pulled down a statue of Stalin in the middle of Budapest. And that's a symbolic rejection of Soviet rule and communism. And that's, well, that's not good in terms of the wider Cold War. The whole justification for these Eastern European states being communist that the Soviet Union had maintained was they want to be communist. But this seemed to be very clear evidence that actually the people did not want to be communist. It was also dangerous for Khrushchev because, of course, he's dealing with de-Stalinization. So there's a worry amongst other Communist Party officials in the Soviet Union that this sort of behaviour, this might be the result of all the de-Stalinization and criticism of Stalin, and where would it end up? Now, initially, Khrushchev's policy is not to intervene directly in Hungary, but he does send a message to the Hungarian Communist Party and basically orders Giro out of power. So Giro's sacked, he's got rid of, and he's replaced by two guys. One, I've forgotten his name now, but one of them was Sordova, I think that was it. Was that his name? Anyway, there was a former very popular World War II general who became president, and that's, obviously that's an honorary position really under communist rule. What was really important is Imre Nagy, who had returned from Switzerland previously, had joined the Communist Party and had become a kind of key figure on the moderate wing of the Communist Party. He ends up becoming the new leader of the Communist Party in Hungary. And basically his mission is to make the people of Hungary love communism. Okay, and Nagy seems like the right sort of guy. He's now a communist, but he was the leader of the Independent Smallholders Party, and he's very popular with Hungarian people. So he claims that he's going to change things, and first action, he orders the Red Army out of Hungary. Okay, so he says, right, well, I say orders. He politely requested that they withdraw, and Khrushchev obliged with this, and the Red Army starts leaving Hungary, which makes the Hungarian people very, very happy, and it's a sign of progress. Now, I think Khrushchev, I'm kind of guessing here, there's no evidence for this, but Khrushchev probably felt, well, that's enough, and it's going to save a bit of money, make people happy. But Nagy didn't want to stop there. He had plans. He wanted to go forward with free, genuinely free and fair elections, maybe with an alternative party that could stand against the communists. Again, this is kind of one of the reformers' ideas. Let people have a choice and we'll convince them that communism's so good they might as well stick with it. He also wanted to introduce proper trials with independent judges, free and fair evidence being submitted, the rule of law, all those sorts of things we take for granted. He'd also end the secret police and the false imprisonments. Perhaps most of those possibly could have been tolerated by Khrushchev, but the big sticking point was that following the formation of the Warsaw Pact in 1955, which was meant to be a kind of delayed response to the formation of NATO, it was meant to be a defensive alliance officially, but a lot of Hungarians at the time thought it was a threat, and it was another way of imposing Soviet control on Hungary, making it kind of it is a satellite state and binding it ever more closely to the Soviet Union, which they weren't happy about. So the Warsaw Pact had only been formed in 1955. This Hungarian uprising is in 1956. And there's even floated by Nagy the possibility, doesn't say it's definite, but possibility that Hungary could leave the Warsaw Pact. Okay. Now, the Hungarians loved this. Okay. And it led to lots of celebration. A lot of Hungarians are very happy at these changes. Now, we're going to do a slight detour over to America, where President Dwight Eisenhower kind of welcomes these all these statements, all these reforms coming out of Hungary. And he makes a speech. Oh, sorry, little cough there. But he makes a speech implying, directly or indirectly, again, it is all disputed, but gave a message that suggested that America might support Hungary if it became more democratic, and it might support it militarily. Or at least that, I mean, the message was ambiguous, but the Hungarians took it to be a signal or a promise that the Americans would possibly intervene and help the Hungarians break free of Soviet control. Khrushchev is not happy about this. I say, for him, any country leaving the Warsaw Pact is a big no-no. So while he may have been able to tolerate the others, he cannot accept any idea that there would be a state leaving the Warsaw Pact. And Eisenhower's speech, while quite ambiguous, really angers Khrushchev, and I have no proof of this, but he is famous for taking his shoe off and banging it, and he probably did that at this moment. Bang it, go no, 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 no. And he also is worried, as are a number of high-ups, that the Hungarians, having been given some reforms, are now wanting even more reforms. While they were happy for the Red Army to withdraw, they weren't expecting all these changes and Hungary to leave the Warsaw Pact. So Khrushchev does an about turn, and he actually now orders the Red Army back in. So the tanks turn around and start heading back into Hungary. This leads to open clashes and fights in the streets, including the streets of Budapest. It's an uprising. You wouldn't go as far as calling it a war, but definitely there's an armed incursion, and the Hungarians meet it with armed resistance. Okay, not the Hungarian army, because that's under the control of the Communist Party. This is ordinary people taking to the streets and trying to resist the Soviet incursion. So, a few stats for you. This bit of conflict ends up seeing 3,000 Hungarians killed in the fighting, and 1,000 Russians were also killed in the fighting. So, yeah, when you compare it to something like World War II, obviously not a massive number, but in the context of a small in the context of an uprising and suppression, 3,000, a lot, 4,000 in total, a lot of people died in the fighting. And also 200,000 Hungarians were displaced and ended up fleeing to neutral countries, mostly into Austria, which was neither NATO nor the Warsaw Pact, but it was developing into a capitalist state. And a lot of Hungarians thought, well, maybe at this moment Eisenhower will send in the US troops and he'll help us against this Soviet incursion. We clearly have the Soviets invading. And there were protests calling for justice and demanding the Americans to come in and save the day. Unfortunately, America at this precise moment was slightly distracted. And that's because of an event called the Suez Crisis. Now, you don't need to know lots about the Suez Crisis, but basically, the Suez Canal is a private canal. That had been built and run by a private company, the Suez Canal Company, to link a series of, I think it's four lakes, and it allows ocean travel between the Red Sea, which links to the Indian Ocean, through to the Mediterranean. And it means, this is why the British and French did it, for imperial reasons, it means you don't have to sail all the way around Africa to go to the colonies that you had in Asia. So it was really important for imperial ambitions as well as for general international trade. It's still very important for international trade, as we found out last year when a boat got stuck there and it really disrupted things. Anyway, a nationalist leader had taken over, called Nasser. He'd taken over in Egypt, and he had nationalised or taken over the Suez Canal. Now, it's still open for trade and so on, but the British and French said, we want it back. And so they concocted this crazy plan where they would kind of fake an attack on themselves, and they'd use that as a justification to seize control of the Suez Canal. And they would ask Israel for help. Oh, they'd work together with Israel. It was kind of a whole mixed bag there. Now, the Israeli military did quite well, ended up seizing the Sinai Peninsula. That causes troubles elsewhere. But the British and French made a complete mess of it, got all caught, and it was utterly humiliating. And basically, Eisenhower had to sort this out and basically say, what are you two doing? What are you crazy? You didn't tell me about this. You just go and attack Egypt and it's strategically so important. This is just stupid, you old imperial powers. What are you doing? So he was distracted by the Suez Crisis and therefore didn't want to get involved in a direct confrontation with the Soviet Union by supporting Hungary at this time. So the Soviet Union ends up imposing control and Nagy is ordered out. And he is going to be replaced by a new hardline communist called Kadar. So Nagy is basically removed from his position as leader of the Hungarian Communist Party, and Kadar ends up taking over. Now, if Rákosi was a hardline communist, Kadar is an ultra hardline communist. He decides that he's had enough of the relaxed fist. He's going to reclench it and make sure hardline communism is imposed again. So he has 35,000 Hungarians arrested and imprisoned. 300 are executed. These are key moderate communists and supporters of Nagy's changes. Obviously, this is really depressing for the Hungarians, and they realise this is the way it's going to go, and it kind of destroys any sense of protest, particularly with the Americans not backing them. They're on their own, and they realise they've got no chance of standing up to the Soviet Union. Now, Kader will allow some basic reforms, very, very limited reforms to exist, but he desperately rolls back all the reforms that Nagy had initially promised. So he realises he can't just get rid of them completely, but he kind of keeps a little bit of goodwill by saying we'll have very minor little reforms, but most of them will be scaled right back to allow hardline communism to be reimposed. He makes it very, very clear that under no circumstances will Hungary be leaving the Warsaw Pact. That's kind of a big red line issue. So while he will allow some minor reforms for some elements of free speech, or at least allowing there to be a semblance of free press, things like that. But the Warsaw Pact says, nope, we're staying in that. There is no chance of us leaving it. And the Hungarians, kind of defeated at this point, go, what's the point? Nagy is in a bit of trouble here. He's gone into hiding in the Yugoslavian embassy. Again, remember, Yugoslavia had initially been a kind of satellite state associated with communism, and it was a communist state. However, Yugoslavia had made itself communist under Marshal Tito rather than having it imposed by the Soviet Union, and in order to accept martial aid they'd basically broken away from Stalin's control. So the Yugoslavian embassy in Budapest was kind of a safe haven that Nagy went to and hid. Yes, it was communist, but it was a communist state that, well, basically really didn't like the Soviet Union. So he was safe while he was in there. Now, he didn't really fancy spending the rest of his life in the Yugoslavian embassy, a bit like Julian Assange tried to do in the Ecuadorian embassy. But he knew if he left, as soon as he set foot outside the embassy, he could be arrested and then he'd be in the hands of the hardline communists. In the end, he was lured out because they promised him, he was promised by Kader that he would have safe passage to Yugoslavia or to Austria, and he'd basically be allowed to go free. He'd just be exiled from his country. However, this was a lie. As soon as he set out, well, not quite as soon as he set foot outside, but once he left the Yugoslavian embassy, Nagy was arrested and he was sent to Romania, which was under the control of communist leader Ceausescu, and he was quite brutal and hardline. And Ceausescu tortures and eventually executes Imre Nagy. And that is the final bit of the Hungarian uprising. It has been crushed, and Hungary is back under absolute hardline control. Some very minor reforms, but substantially nothing had changed. Which was very, very upsetting for the Hungarian people. Now, what are the key things to learn or to remember from the Hungarian uprising? First of all, it demonstrated that people in Hungary, at least, or possibly elsewhere in Eastern Europe, were not happy living under communist rule. And this is going to link in nicely to the Berlin Wall being built, which is for a couple of episodes' time. It was also clear that the USSR dominated Warsaw Pact countries. It wasn't a mutual alliance. It was very much one dominant figure that told the others what to do. It also showed that Khrushchev's de-Stalinization would only go so far. He was happy to do it as long as it was making him popular. But as soon as it looked like it might weaken communist control or lead to reforms he couldn't support, then he'd cut it down and he'd use very similar methods to impose Soviet control. It also shows the limitations of the USA wanting to get involved, and actually kind of the success or the implementation of the Truman Doctrine. Hungary was a Soviet-controlled area, and the USA did not interfere in it, because where communism already existed, they would accept it. They just didn't want it to spread or expand any further, and that's another reason why Eisenhower was more bothered about Egypt, which wasn't communist, and that the British and French and Israeli attack might push it towards communism, as the enemy of my enemy is my friend, so to speak. So it shows that, and also that their willingness to get involved in a major conflict in Europe is limited. So a lot of those states that are communist that might have seen a population rise up and rebel, feeling a bit let down by the USA and that the USA's promise of support for non-NATO members was going to be limited. And it also shows that the Soviet Union was prepared to use military force to retain its control over the satellite states. So anyone who still believed that Hungary and these other states were communist through choice and could leave if they wanted to, well, those ideas were shot down. It's very clear that communism will be retained by force, for the time being at least. And 1956 also kind of marks the end of the first third, if you like, the first big period of the Cold War, where it's gone from that initial friendliness, in inverted commas, I'm doing the inverted comma signs. Always good on a podcast to do visual clues. But yeah, from that sort of alliance that existed during the Nazi attacks and during World War II, how it is completely gone now. The Iron Curtain has been drawn. There's been the arms race. And it's very clear that Eastern Europe is going to be dominated and controlled by the Soviet Union. America will have control over Western Europe through NATO and influence elsewhere. And so Hungary is kind of the last part of this early establishing of the Cold War. The pattern is basically set now. What we will look at next, or what I'll talk to you about, and hopefully you'll get some benefit from, is we'll look at the sort of middle period, which is symbolised by three main sort of crises, being, well, we'll start with the Bay of Pigs, which is kind of a whole Cuban thing. So I'm going to do Cuba in two parts, with the Berlin Wall being built in the middle, and then the Prague Spring. And spoilers, the Prague Spring is almost exactly, a few differences, almost exactly like the Hungarian uprising, but a little bit later. So we'll talk about that again. Hope this has been useful. And yes, I look forward to coming to you again soon with the Bay of Pigs. Take care and thank you. Please do feel free to put in any comments in the comments box, and or any feedback or ratings, whatever. This is an educational podcast, so there's no profit. I don't do it for money or anything like that. That's why there shouldn't be any adverts. But I hope they're useful. And yeah, thank you very much for your time and for listening. Bye.